From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new film, Selma, from director Ava DuVernay, is powerful, instructive, timely. It goes into the streets and behind the scenes 50 years ago this spring to Alabama, bullwhips, billy clubs, to the White House of LBJ and the inner circle of Martin Luther King, its struggles and its strategy to change a nation. King got the Voting Rights Act. Now we've got Ferguson and I Can't Breathe. This hour on Point, the movie Selma, the real history and lessons now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you see it this weekend? Selma, what are the lessons, the resonance of Selma and the March to Montgomery today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's just a little bit from the trailer for Selma. The president, President Johnson, played by Tom Wilkinson, FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, played by Dylan Baker, trying to figure out Dr. King's next move.
He's got supporters. Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, inciting large-scale arrests and sympathy marches.
I'm very aware of that, Mr. Hoover.
What I do know is nonviolent. What I need to know right now, what's Martin Luther King about to do next?
Well, Martin Luther King was thinking a lot about that as portrayed in this film. With us now from New York is Wesley Morris, film reviewer for the online journal Grantland. He won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for criticism for his work at the Boston Globe. His review of the new movie Selma went up on Grantland on Friday. You can find that review at our website, link to it, read it, onpointradio.org. Wesley, very good to have you right here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
We've read your long and really interesting review here, but just take it from the heart first. What was your reaction as an African-American, as an American, as a movie critic to this movie?
Wow, that's three different responses.
Yes.
I mean, they overlap.
Okay.
I think the movie is really strong. I think that one of the strengths is that it really isn't about what it appears to be, which is a movie about Martin Luther King. Officially it is called Selma, but I think the impression that people are getting is that it's a movie biography about Martin Luther King.
Mm.
But really, to me, and I don't think I'm interpreting this. I mean, I think it actually is a movie about the climate in which the Voting Rights Act came to be passed and the pressures that were put upon the White House and the pressures that were put upon the civil rights leaders to get it passed. I mean, it was an urgent – it was urgent to get these roadblocks to voting cleared out of the way so that people were actually able to change the people, to get rid of the people, to vote them out who were oppressing them. And the movie does a very good job of arguing. The film is by Ava DuVernay, we should say. She directed the film. The screenplay is credited to Paul Webb. And I think that one of the strengths is just that it is showing you the process by which not just the Voting Rights Act came to be, but the process by which you have to sort of think about how to direct any sort of political action and what it means to really sit down and strategize about how to affect change. And I think that's the thing that's resonant in 2014 and 2015 is just, the ongoing problems that affect race relations in this country are kind of lacking, from the standpoint of the people who were doing the protests and having the demonstrations. There doesn't seem to be a sort of cohesive goal for some of this stuff, according to people who are either on the ground or watching people on the ground.
I mean, that's what really struck me. You see Martin Luther King, and of course, it is not just about him. Fascinating how it looks at his whole inner circle and the people of Selma who stepped up in a big way here. But you see in Martin Luther King here, a brave man, you see a moralist, high moralist, but above all in Ava DuVernay's presentation here, Wesley, you see a master strategist. He's using the suffering in the streets and the media coverage he know it will get to directly put a crowbar under Lyndon Baines Johnson in the White House.
Yes, and I think, the pressure – I mean, I think that one of the things you feel watching this film is that there is pressure from all sides on every party. And there are people prevailing upon – there are different forces prevailing upon other forces to do what in the minds of whoever's doing the prevailing is the right thing. And I think the moment at which you have that siege on the – or that attack with the Selma law enforcement – on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and the nation sees this, and it sort of spurs to action lots of other people watching this in their homes who want to come down to Alabama and join the movement, like physically donate their bodies and potentially, and in several cases actually, their lives to the civil rights movement.
I mean, it's bone-chilling even now to see her presentation of that attack on the marchers on the bridge. And even after everything we saw in Ferguson with the big guns trained on the audience, on the assembled people in the streets there, I mean, here it really is the billy clubs and bullwhips and police on horseback just riding people down, nearly killing them on the bridge.
Yeah, the cavalry. I mean, it's a cavalry. And the idea that, I mean, you know, you asked sort of what one of the questions that came out of the Ferguson situation, I remember just visually, was just how overmatched the protesters seemed given the militarization of the Ferguson police force. And the question was whether the visual discrepancy between these unarmed, peaceful protesters sort of warranted this militarized response. And what it's, you know, it's not to that extreme in Selma, but what you do think about is the way in which violence and force, you know, the pressure to get violent action to happen to you when you are otherwise peacefully protesting, you know, whether or not it's warranted is something that really comes through, at least, I mean, especially in that sequence. And then there's a night sequence that the police sort of ambush a bunch of protesters at night and wind up shooting an activist named Jimmie Lee Jackson.
Mm-hmm. Central moment in the film. A bullet takes him down. But, of course, the repression is not all about billy clubs or even bullets. It goes right down, and this is the heart of it, to people can't vote. There are so many roadblocks thrown in their way. And Martin Luther King is saying to the LBJ, as long as they can't vote, they can't control their world, their lives. Here's a scene where the character from history, Annie Lee Cooper, a real figure in the movement, played by Oprah Winfrey in the new movie Selma. She's at the county courthouse. You may have heard some of this, but she's trying to register to vote. A very dignified African-American woman there in 1964-65, facing a wall of intimidation and hurdles from the court's clerk.
You work for Mr. Dunn down at the rest home, ain't that right?
Yes, sir.
Wonder what old Dunn will say when I tell him one of his gals down here stirring a fuss.
I ain't stirring no fuss. I'm just here trying to register to vote.
Recite the Constitution's preamble. You know what a preamble is?
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Oprah Winfrey there as Annie Lee Cooper trying to register to vote. And, of course, he goes on to ask her, name all 67. She lands a blow later in the film at a very interesting moment. Wesley Morris, stand by. I want to also bring into our conversation right now Dr. Mary Frances Berry, professor of American social thought and history at the University of Pennsylvania. Delighted to have her with us today. Former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, personal friend of Martin Luther and Coretta Scott King and many of the key figures in the civil rights movement, many depicted in the movie Selma. For her book, And Justice for All, she studied all the presidential papers in the civil rights movement. Her latest book is called We Are Who We Say We Are. Dr. Berry joins us from New Orleans. Dr. Berry, Mary Frances Berry, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What was your reaction to the film and the intimate depiction of people you knew so well?
Well, I thought that some of them, I was amazed at the way she caught their characters, since this was a movie and not a documentary. Mm-hmm. Coretta was very much like Coretta. I appreciated seeing Martin as the strategist and all of the sort of indecision that he had about what to do, which has been well documented by academic historians. As he moved along and never being really sure that this, that, or the other would happen. But the strategists and showing black leadership making decisions rather than having white people make them for them. And also some of the other people like Jimmie G. Jackson, who had been overlooked. He was not part of history. And Miss Viola Liuzzo, the white woman from Detroit, has been lost to history and this was is key to the
Mr.
movie.
Jackson, who Wesley mentioned, who was shot, Viola, who was shot after the march had finally reached Montgomery. She was driving people back to Selma, and the some Klansmen stopped and shot her on the way back.
Yes, and her reputation was smeared, and press and the right-wingers all claimed she was down there on some nefarious, vulgar mission, when in fact she was just an activist, and she was shot. So I was happy to see her in the movie, and I thought that the movie captured the grassroots people, the ordinary people. Someone asked me once, how is it that ordinary people in the South who had been so oppressed had enough gumption or enough courage, intelligence to do anything? And I said they were human beings, and they, in fact, knew. And also there were people in the South in all of those different families, and you could see it with some of the protesters who came from the North, black people who had either migrated in the Great Migration, their families had, and they were back, or they'd been off in the service or whatever. So you had people from different places. I mean, Coretta and Martin, of course, went to school in Boston and went back to the South. I used to ask Coretta all the time, why did you guys go back? She said, because we wanted to be part of making change. And that's true of so many people. So I was inspired by the movie, seeing characters like C.T. Vivian, who no one ever talks about, who was there. And it was great. And the role even of Ralph Abernathy.
Yes.
So I was inspired by it. I thought it was a wonderful movie, and I loved it.
Dr. Mary Frances Berry, please stand by in New Orleans. Wesley Morris with Grantland in New York. Here from the movie, I've got the new world in my view. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Let the church say amen. Let's wake up now and get in line. I got the new world in my view. On my journey, I pursue. I said I'm running, running for the city. I got the new world in my view. I got the new world in my view. On my journey, I pursue. I said I'm running, running for the city. I got the new world in my view.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new movie Selma, from the heart of the civil rights struggle 50 years ago, and how it resonates, lights up our struggles today. I'm joined by Wesley Morris. He's a staff writer for the online culture journal Grantland, joins us from New York, and by Dr. Mary Frances Berry, professor of American social thought and professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. There are daytime marches where there is a commitment to nonviolence depicted here in the movie Selma. There are nighttime marches where, as depicted, local authorities right up to Governor George Wallace sort of give the all clear to go out and be really rough after one young man is killed by police, as depicted here overnight. You've got the Reverend Martin Luther King, played by Danny Oyelowo, talking to a packed church in Selma, pressing, as he pressed the President of the United States then, for the right to vote.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest. That means march. That means disturb the peace. That means jail. That means risk. And that is hard.
A powerful moment. And before the film is over, we come to understand that LBJ was persuaded. The Voting Rights Act was put on the table and it passed. But here we are 50 years later, or 49, last summer in August, demonstrations unfolding in Ferguson, Missouri. Here's St. Louis County resident Stephen Wilkins sharing his thoughts with PIX 11 News, speaking in his home as police officers stood across the street.
You have a picture from 2014 and a picture from 1960, and they're looking damn near identical. They got the dogs out. And there's a problem. You telling me we ain't made no progress in 50 years? My mom and them marched with Martin Luther King. You know what I'm saying? Where's the progress?
Dr. Mary Frances Berry in New Orleans, what do you say to that young man in Ferguson last summer?
Right. Let me say something about that. I wrote a chapter in a book called Long Memory called Blacks and the Politics of Redemption. Mm-hmm. And I said that once we got the vote, we were going to have to see whether you actually were redeemed, and all the things that we hoped for would come to pass in terms of power and equality and so on. What is disappointing, and as you see the film, what is so sad is all the sacrifices people made to get the vote.
Yes.
And even now, some people don't vote. Turnout's not very good. Mm-hmm. It's better among blacks than other people. Mm-hmm. But even after you vote, some of my students say to me, and all the young people that I go around with say to me, exactly what that young man said. Here we are all these years later, and even when we do vote and we vote people in office, we hear people talking about how unemployment is getting better, but the black unemployment rate has been twice the rate of whites. It's at 10.6 right now, while the national one is 5-something. And they point out all of these things that happen and the police abuse and all the rest of it. And they say, well, the vote doesn't seem to – and I had said in that book that the vote isn't going to get you to the promised land. You got to do other stuff, hold people accountable and so on. So one of the sad things is that all those people marched and died and went to jail and got beaten mm-hmm. and sacrificed – and yet still the vote is held out to us as the promise of equality, and yet it hasn't done it. But there's something else, and that is the need to press on and the need to keep pressing and pressing and pressing and not just use the vote. I think that's the message that comes across.
Boy, the opposition was fierce then when you see those National Guard and police lined up at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. This is the actual sound, not the movie, but the actual sound from March 7, 1965. You had Alabama National Guard, mounted police led by the infamous Sheriff Clark there, marchers standing stock still facing the armed cordons, Commanding Officer John Cloud calling, this is historical tape, on his bullhorn for the marchers to disperse.
It'll be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse. You are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church. This march will not continue.
And boom, there came kind of the onslaught right there. Renee is calling from Hampton, Virginia. Renee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. Hi. I wanted to just say that I saw the movie over the weekend, and it was just one of the most profoundly excellent movies that I had ever seen in my life. It was just really good, very multidimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It showed the interplay and the dynamics between groups. Mm-hmm. It showed not only how individuals had to determine what to do against a political system that was inherently racist, but also what they had to do between generational
mm-hmm.
Discourse. And it was just very well done, well played, multifaceted, just all dimensions.
Renee, what did you think of how Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was presented, how Coretta Scott King was presented, their relationship under pressure from the FBI?
I really appreciated that we finally saw a very comprehensive aspect of their humanity. They were very human characters.
Mm-hmm.
They were believable. Very, you understood that they had human foibles, that they were able to work through things, and just the importance of the bond and the relationship. That has never been played out as well on a screen for me.
And the way the FBI put sexual infidelity right in the face of this couple and made them deal with it, how do you think about how that was portrayed?
Well, I thought that that was portrayed very well, because in one particular aspect, you saw that individuals were able to do all sorts of things to try to skew what the truth would be. And so even though he indicated that, Corey, that's not me, we were able to see that she had to weigh what she knew about relationships and
mm-hmm.
about being able to persevere through whatever was going on. And she was going through so much.
In a larger cause, persevere.
Yes.
I really appreciated the way it dealt with that subtlety of human nature. Renee, I appreciate your call. Wesley Morris, how about that? I thought the depiction of Coretta Scott King by Carmen Iago is just tremendous, very, very nuanced here, and not easy to pull off to show how she could simultaneously deal with human foibles and great public issues in this pressure cooker, Wesley.
Yeah, I mean, she is... what Carmen Ogozo does here is very interesting because it's not it's complicated. You know, she has a complicated part, and if you she knows everything that presumably the American people don't know about her marriage. Mm. And she also understands that she is part of a movement, and then the movement has to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'd be really curious to know how Professor Barry feels about it. I just, you know.
Yes, let me tell you how I feel about it. The movie was great in showing one aspect of Coretta, and it was the Coretta I knew. There's another aspect of her that we ought to understand. It's important. Coretta was a strategist, too. And Coretta, mm-hmm. we often mm-hmm. overlook the women in this thing.
Though less in this movie, perhaps, than some others. But yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Coretta, in fact, was the first one to know about study nonviolence and, in fact, talk to Martin about it. And she was a person who, over the years that I knew her, before and after, mm-hmm. all her life, she could strategize with the best of them. And she knew it was a larger cause that they were involved in, whatever the human frailties mm-hmm, that were involved. Mm-hmm. And that in marriages, you make accommodations. Anybody who's ever been married knows
yep,
that
yep.
Or had a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they showed one dimension of her very well, but there's a missing one. And I wanted to quickly mention one other thing that's in the movie that people don't hear about. Mm-hmm. Diane Nash was shown in that movie.
Activist, young woman who was very
And she is one of the overlooked mm-hmm. persons who was mm-hmm. a student at Fisk, come down from Chicago, mm-hmm. and who led during the Freedom Riots. And in fact, if it hadn't been for her, the Freedom Riots would have been stopped in Alabama. And she insisted on going down there and getting the students together and going on to Mississippi. And she was in the movement. She's still around, still active, still very vibrant. Mm-hmm. But the role that she played in SNCC, for the first time I've seen it in on the big screen. There was a TV thing on television. So all of those – the women in the civil rights movement, you saw Annie Lee Cooper. Mm-hmm. But also the wives of those men who were there, who were leaders, mm-hmm. were very key and important too.
So intimate.
I would also say that there's that great scene in the movie where Malcolm X comes to Selma.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And
talks to Coretta.
Yeah, he calls for Coretta. And, you know, she wrote – she has an autobiography or a book about her time with Martin Luther King that came out in, I believe, 1969 or 1970. And she describes that scene, and it pretty much is the way it happens in the film. The film does some things with time and the timeline of these events. But I thought, I mean, that conversation they have where she basically tells him, she intends to tell him to get out of Selma. Yeah. And he winds up telling her that, look, I'm willing to make myself the bad guy here in order to scare these powerful white people into realizing it. You could have it a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Right. It could be me and my more militant approach here, not Dr. King.
Right.
Yeah. Here's, of course, the climax of the film, in a way. What it produces is a speech by LBJ. This pressure brought to bear by Dr. King and all those around him and the people in Selma and all those who come, because there are three marches. They fail the first time. They turn back the second time. They call, and people come from the north and beyond to join them on March 15th, 1965. And again, this is history. President Johnson, before Congress on national TV, calls for the Voting Rights Act. This is only 8 days after Bloody Sunday at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Here's the president.
Their cause must be our cause, too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
What words from the President of the United States there? Julian Zelizer joins us now, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. His new book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Julian Zelizer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You have raised concerns about the depiction of LBJ in this film that have gotten a lot of attention. What's your core concern?
Well, let me start by saying I think the movie is phenomenal and it gets something right, that the movement was instrumental at moving Congress on this and many other issues. Mm-hmm. It didn't come from all inside Washington. That's the effect the grassroots activists had, and the movie captures it. Johnson, I think, is portrayed as somewhat indifferent and at some points hostile to voting rights. There's a lot on J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and the investigations, which actually, you know, really start with JFK and his brother, Robert Kennedy. The concern is simply that it created an unnecessary debate, that Johnson, by early January 1965, is firmly in favor of voting rights. He is privately and secretly having his attorney general draft the legislation. His people are working with senators in both parties in February, a month before the marches, to negotiate a basic framework for the bill. And the basic debate was over when, not if. Johnson was scared. He didn't think he had enough power to push another civil rights bill in March. King urged him to do that and refused to wait any longer. So I think that was really the debate. And I just thought it was a bit too negative in terms of how LBJ comes off in the film.
But the core premise of the film is that Johnson wasn't going there on the timetable that MLK felt was urgent, and he wouldn't have done it in that spring without Selma. Do you not buy that?
Oh, I agree 100%. That's kind of the thesis of the book. Mm-hmm. So I agree with that. And
he would not have without the sacrifice.
He was very explicit. He mm-hmm. wanted to wait until later in the year. He thought bills like Medicare and education needed to come first. He thought those would help African Americans and white Americans. And he was very scared about the limits of his power. Even with these huge majorities, he was scared if he sent this bill, a lot of moderate Democrats would get scared of the backlash that would emerge. And so, you know, he tells Martin Luther King in January 15th, I'm in favor of this, but I'm going to need help. I'm going to need help shaping and moving members of Capitol Hill to vote for this bill. And that's, you know, it was a real partnership, which is what comes off the tapes and comes off the record that I think was quite special and quite remarkable.
Can I say
Barry,
something
please,
about
yes.
that, please? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I read all of the civil rights letters, memos, files mm-hmm. from the Johnson administration, Kennedy administration, mm-hmm. all the way back to Eisenhower, up to the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very familiar with these records, and I knew a lot of the people who were
yes.
involved. So let me just say that it's true. The film, which isn't a documentary, of course, doesn't make Johnson out as being opposed to voting rights. There's nothing in the film
that
says Lyndon Johnson didn't believe in black people getting voting rights. Mm-hmm. That's not true. Mm-hmm. I think what people are objecting to is they didn't like Johnson appearing to be the villain. And Hollywood likes villains, mm-hmm. and somebody had to be the villain. I think that Lyndon Johnson, if they had made Lyndon Johnson part of the savior in the whole, you know, white savior in
yeah.
the movie who always comes up,
yeah.
this movie would get an Academy Award. Mm-hmm. I think since it didn't, and since it's been attacked by so many powerful people, that it probably won't. And that's too bad. But it shows the continued existence of racism in our society and how polarizing it is and the unwillingness to accept black leadership, that we can't understand that the people at the grassroots level were demanding action then. They were pressing Martin. Martin, it's clear even from the movie, Martin Luther King didn't want to move as quickly, but he was forced to. And he was forcing Johnson to. They had a good relationship compared to what he had with Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. But in fact, he had to press him if he was going to get it done now. That was the fierce urgency of now, Professor Zelizer.
And he was pushing very hard. Dr. Mary Frances Berry, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, who knew Martin Luther King, Curtis Scott King, and many of the other leaders depicted here, please stand by. Wesley Morris, staff writer for Grantland. Julian Zelizer, out with a new book, The Fierce Urgency of Now. John Legend behind us here from the movie Selma. Join us, 800-423-8255. This is On Point.
That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground. The camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new movie Selma, from the heart of the civil rights struggle 50 years ago this spring, and how it resonates, lights up our struggles today. In history, March 25th of that year, 1965, at the end of the third and final Selma March, 25,000 people stood before the steps of the state capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama, where the governor, George Wallace, had said, "Segregation now, segregation forever." And there, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous speech, "How Long, Not Long." Here's some of what he has to say as the TV cameras actually rolled and the world watched. 1965.
"We are going to walk nonviolently and peacefully. To let the nation and the world know that we are tired now. We've lived with slavery and segregation 345 years. We waited a long time for freedom. We are trying to remind the nation of the urgency of the moment. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time."
Now, in 1965, here we are, 2015, Ferguson, Staten Island, all the rest. Here's Samuel L. Jackson calling on people to sing this song in 2015. Not over yet.
"I can hear my neighbor crying. I can't breathe. Now I'm in the struggle and I can't leave. Calling out the violence of the racist police. We ain't gonna stop till people are free. We ain't gonna stop till people are free."
50 years after Selma, Dr. Mary Frances Berry is with us, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She's at the University of Pennsylvania now, joins us today from New Orleans. Julian Zelizer is here, Princeton professor of history, public affairs. His new book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, gets right into this history. And Wesley Morris is with us from Grantland, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic there who's written wonderfully. You can link to it at our website. With us right now from Brooklyn is Dante Berry. He is director of the Million Hoodies Movement for Justice, which was formed in response to the murder of Trayvon Martin. He's 26 years old. He was invited by organizers of the Ferguson, Missouri protest to come and up organize there in Missouri, which he did. Dante Berry, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
People will see this movie and see Dr. King. Yes, there's indecision, but he is also portrayed as a great strategist who kind of has the whole nation's attention and very carefully lays out a series of events in Selma that end up, you know, bringing major legislation to bear in this country. When you watch that as a kind of civil rights leader today, what do you think of the criticism that we're missing that leadership, that kind of strategic approach today, Dante?
Yes. So I did get to see Selma a couple of weeks ago, actually, and I also had the opportunity to be in a meeting with Representative John Lewis on Friday, me and a bunch of eight other black leaders in different organizations met with the Congressional Black Caucus.
He, of course, was there in Selma at the time, very centrally there. What are you taking away from all of it, Dante?
Yeah, so I think that overall, we've been able to still see a lot of the strategy that's being played. I think often when you have a movie that is talking about the history of black folks and it's led by white people, you don't necessarily get the context as like some of those details of actually the details of what's actually on the ground, what's happening, what are the strategy decisions being made. And I think this movie really helps lift up that Martin Luther King Jr. was a radical. He was principled, he was strategic, and he executed tactically on his strategies, right? And I think what we see there in Selma is a full unraveling of that picture. And you're seeing that playing out today. But I think also specifically in terms of the differences between Selma in 1965 and 1964 rather than in today is that this movement is very decentralized. And it was very decentralized at that point too. But this is specifically decentralized because we don't necessarily need one particular leader. This movement actually is leader full. So we don't have a question around if this movement is leader-less.
Dante, hold that thought, if I may take it to Dr. Mary Frances Berry in New Orleans. Dr. Berry, what about civil rights organizing then and now, what we see in the movie versus what we see today around Ferguson and more?
I tell Dante, who is probably my cousin, that, because he's a Barry, that, in fact, I admire what the brother's doing and what all the young people are doing. But when we did the Free South Africa Movement, which was patterned after the nonviolent strategy of the civil rights movement, because all of us were in it, we discovered that you had to have one leader. You could have a lot of different leaders, but publicly there had to be somebody because the media always wants to go talk to one person. Occupy Wall Street found out that was a problem. So some way has to be found, and the people in the 60s found that out too, that you had to like bring the groups that were scattered together somehow and have some kind of leadership thing. And then Martin ended up being, as John says in the movie, picked by the people to be the leader down there. So I don't know how you're going to sort that all out, but there has to be some kind of public face of the movement if it's going to be successful. But I wanted to get one other thing in, is, which is that you need to have a figure who has power who will respond to what you do, your activity, and will not be so negative, like the President Johnson. Mm-hmm. He, in fact, ended up being the best civil rights president we had ever had in the end. He could have said, no, I'm going to be like George Wallace and say, beat these guys over the head and don't do anything. And he did sign the civil rights bill, of course. So, Dante, I think that there's going to be a struggle. There can be lots of different leaders, but somehow there has to be some kind of coordinating group for the Black Lives Matter and the I Can't Breathe movement for it to. And the other thing you need is persistence. In the civil rights movement, there were always people who thought the movement was over. You know, different things would happen, and people say, well, that's over.
That's it.
But it wasn't. You got to, behind the scenes and with the people, you got to be persistent. And I don't mean to be didactic, but that's one of the lessons.
It's just required. Dante Barry?
I want to interject quickly because I want to say that that actually is happening. And there's a number of groups that, and organizations across the country that are coordinating. So when I say that it's decentralized and that it's leader, it's not leaderless, it's leaderful.
Okay.
Meaning that there's so many leaders that are taking action. And we've seen over...
But I can't name a Dr. King, to Dr. Barry's point. You know, do you need to channel it through... I mean, maybe he's one of a kind, but do you need to channel it through one ultimately?
But I don't think our generation is is about this charismatic leadership model, right? Where we propose, we go on this Ella Baker mentality and perspective of center leadership, and that I think is a big difference in the sense of what has happened in the 60s and what's happening now. In terms of replicating certain models.
Julian Zelizer, what do you say?
I think it's more than the decentralization or charismatic leader. I mean, what was very important about that period and the film captures is the connection between the grassroots and the movement and the protests and a specific piece of legislation. There was an objective that was very much on the mind of everyone from King to the rest of the grassroots activists, and they were pushing for that voting rights bills. And the marchers were literally coordinated to build pressure on Congress so that the president would have the room to get this bill through. And I would say that sometimes that seems to be lacking today in terms of a very clear, specific objective. And I think ultimately that makes movement building harder because you don't know exactly where you're going with this. And there's not a tangible outcome that certainly we could look back to 1965 and see.
Wesley Morris, how did this movie, Selma, light up the current circumstances in your mind? I mean, you've got all kinds of Twitter hashtags and activism now and people in the streets. It has to be said, to Dante Barry's point. But here you are looking at this very powerful depiction of what happened in 65. And we've all been looking since last summer at a lot of activity around Ferguson and more. Compare and contrast, Wesley. Where does it leave you thinking?
Well, I mean, I think that for one thing, you have in Selma, you have a film that's about all kinds of leadership. But as Professor Barry said, I mean, you know, there has to be a focal point both for the media and for the power structure that you're trying to communicate with. I think, you know, what's interesting to me, I mean, obviously the movie is resonant from 1965 to 2015 and 2014 for just the sort of presentation of these physical, of these people sort of gathered together, these physical bodies, the bodies assembled on the bridge, and Ava DuVernay shows them walking very orderly, like from one point in the city across the street. Very, it's like single file or double file at some point. It's actually wider than that, but it seems it's very orderly. They're on the bridge. I mean, the idea that it wasn't just this sort of political strategy of how you communicate power to power. It's how you present the struggle, the march forward, and the physicality of all those civil rights marches. It's just very striking to me. And, you know, it's funny, the thing that I'm
thinking
about
is, there's an order to it that you didn't see in Ferguson exactly. Different time, different place, but you're right. I mean, they're lined up and marching. Of course, we saw that in documentary footage from the time.
Well, what you have now, I mean, you had the die-ins, which is a very sort of dramatic, physical representation of something, of a reaction to something that's negative. But I was thinking more about yesterday and what you saw in Paris. And, I mean, the image of all those leaders sort of arm in arm locked, and they're sort of headed down the boulevard. I mean, that is straight – I mean, not straight out of Selma, but, I mean, that is an image that you could take a frame out of that movie and hold it up to this one.
Yes, you could.
And, you know, the sort of civil rights marching, the sort of protest iconography is very strong. The protest iconography that's come out of Ferguson, that's come out of New York, that's come out of other cities that have demonstrated. The question, of course, that everybody is asking, and I think that's what you're hearing today, is what are we presenting to, say, Barack Obama and Eric Holder, or in his replacement? Like, what is the thing, or like, to like, forget the White House. I mean, if you just want to keep it on a city or state level, what is being presented to these governments to change? I mean, I think the question is in some ways sort of abstractly obvious, but I mean, what we're talking about, I guess, is somewhat something more than a change in policy.
I think we're being too hard on Dante and the movement. The movement, the Black Lives Matter and the I Can't Breathe movement, I think some of those young people, some of whom are my students, what they have learned is that telling some one thing to the government and having them do that one thing hasn't solved the problem of police abuse or racism in the society. And what they want to do is to end the inequality, stop the police abuse, figure out some way to do that, and deal with the racism. But the stage that they are, movements have stages. The stage is where they are, I don't think, from what I've observed and what I hear them saying, that they're prepared to go and say, if you do pass this one bill, we will all go home and everything will be fine until the next black guy or woman gets shot. I don't know, Dante. Is that right?
What's the goal, Dante?
Yeah, so there's a few things. So one, I think you're 100% right. There's different stages and movements, and this is infancy right now, meaning that we've gotten to a place where folks are now reactivated. They're no longer sheep. They want to take action. And I think we can leverage these protests strategically, the die-ins, as heartbeats of the movement, right? And also the proliferation of these cases that are going to keep coming up and keep popping up. We're going to keep seeing more people that are being killed. That can help provide some heartbeat to this movement. The second piece, I think, is that this is not a civil rights movement. And I think that folks tend to, like, say that this is a new civil rights movement or that the old one like ended. One, the old one didn't end. We're still fighting it. But this is a different type of movement. This is a movement specifically about transforming power, where the civil rights movement was largely about access to power and having a key right and to guarantee that. But this is about how are we transforming that power so that we are having a more transformed society, right? And then the third piece, there are specific demands, and we've been rolling out these demands since Mike Brown was shot and killed. And you can go to FergusonAction.com to like see these, from the demilitarization of local law enforcement to the passing of the End Racial Profiling Act, to the Obama administration developing and legislating and enacting a national plan of action for racial justice, right? So we have these demands, we have these core pieces, but I want to also put another note on that, is that policy recommendations sometimes lead to band-aid. They are sometimes band-aids in the context.
Right.
So
right.
We also need to be creating cultural interventions, which is why the protests and disruptions are important to this, because we may not necessarily see explicit racism anymore, but we still have the implicit racism that is hidden behind the laws and policies. So there needs to be an awakening in some form.
Dr. Barry, on the right track there, what do you say?
I think he's on the right track, and I wish it the world were like Alan Baker said it should be, but it's not exactly. But he's on the right track, and he's right that if you just say I want one policy recommendation, that's going to solve the problem. It won't. One thing that might help to solve it is if no more black folks are shot under suspicious circumstances where they're not doing anything by police. If that, just say if we had a hiatus and that didn't happen anymore. That would be one sign that the racism was ebbing.
Still aspirational today in 2015. Dr. Mary Frances Berry, joining us from New Orleans today. Thank you so much for being here.
Sure, thanks.
Wesley Morris with Grantland. Great to have you, Wesley. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Julian Zelizer, it's always wonderful to have you. Let's talk again soon. The new book is The Fierce Urgency of Now. Thank you, Professor Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And Dante Barry, director of the Million Hoodies Movement for Justice in Brooklyn, New York. Dante, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Out once more from Selma with Glory by Common and John Legend here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.